nothing about that up here, but apparently down there it's big stuff. And these two farmers had their own stables, and they developed quite a rivalry between each other. So one spring, these farmers entered their horses into a local race, and one of the farmers decided that he's going to get an edge on his competitor, and so he's going to hire a professional jockey this time. So that's what he did. So one day, the race came along, and the race started off, and the racers were cruising around the track, and sure enough, the two farmers with their horses were way out in front. And then the horses came around the bend, and suddenly the two horses that were in front fell down and threw their jockeys along with them. But the hired professional jockey remounted the horse and quickly rode on to win the race. And so he returned triumphantly to the paddock, and the jockey found the farmer. And the farmer that hired him was just absolutely furious. And so this jockey's trying to figure out, what's going on? Why is this farmer so mad at me? What's the matter? The jockey says, I won the race, didn't I? Oh, yeah, roared the farmer. You won all right, but you crossed the finish line on the wrong horse. So in a hurry to remount his horse, he actually jumped on the wrong horse, the competitor's horse, and then the competitor won instead of himself. Success is meaningless because he finished on the wrong horse. Well, you know, we're going to talk about meaninglessness for the next little while. How's that for a subject? Shall we talk about meaninglessness and have a cup of coffee and tea and just chat about meaninglessness? Well, that's what Ecclesiastes is. Ecclesiastes is a very strange book. Has anybody read it recently? Yeah, there you go. It's a strange book, but it's a great book. Ecclesiastes uses the word meaningless multiple times. And so it gives us some obvious hints that this is a predominant theme in this book. So there's a line, a famous line that you know in chapter 1. It goes, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Now, other translations use different words. They might use the word vanity. Probably King James or ESV will use that word. The original Hebrew word for meaningless is actually the word hevel. It's found 38 times in the book of Ecclesiastes, and so it's a predominant theme. Now, Ecclesiastes may sound like a kind of a depressing book. In some ways, it is. Okay, I mean, if you want a quick shot in the arm spiritually, you probably don't go to Ecclesiastes. You go to Psalms or, you know, Colossians or Ephesians to give you a quick pickup. But obviously, this is an important theme to the author. You know, but like some of the other wisdom books of literature, for example, you know, you go to Proverbs and you find a lot about wise living, right? You go to the Song of Songs, you learn about wise marital love. And so when you go to the book of Ecclesiastes, what you have is the wisdom of a naysayer. A wisdom of a naysayer who surprisingly helps us bring more deeper meaning to life, actually. So this is why I'm calling this series in Ecclesiastes, Bringing Meaning to Life. Bringing true meaning to life, perhaps. Does anyone know what a naysayer is? Well, a naysayer is basically someone who comes along and says no a lot. And generally, we don't like naysayers, right? We don't like naysayers. He is a critic who sees all the errors and flaws. And it reminds me of a government building inspector long ago, back in the day when I used to wear a carpenter's pouch in construction. I worked in a food laboratory. We're building a food laboratory for the government. I'm not sure if it's federal, Alberta, probably Alberta. But it was this fancy food laboratory. And we spent a long time trying to make this place right. But once in a while, you would get a visit from the government inspector. And the builders, and then had kind of a, you know, uneasy relationship because these inspectors never said anything nice to you, right? That wasn't their job. You know, that wasn't their job to make you feel good about how your building project was coming along. They were there to tell you everything that you've done wrong and then the stuff you have to do all over again. Well, that's kind of like the teacher, this critic, this naysayer in Ecclesiastes. He's here to observe life and to tell us things that just aren't quite right. But he does it to help us bring true meaning to life. And as you'll come to understand, the voice of the naysayer or the critic brings us an incredibly relevant message, actually for the 21st century. It's clearly relevant. He is the one who helps us understand that we may be riding on the wrong horse, so to speak. You don't want to be entering the end of your life riding on the wrong horse. No one does. So he has the job of clearing the clutter. He's like this garbage picker. He goes into the back alleys of your garbage containers and he sees what you're wasting in your life. So if we listen to his corrections, he actually will set you free to help you bring new meaning to life in Jesus Christ. Okay. Now, because Ecclesiastes is probably a lesser-known book in the Bible, I actually discovered a little video here, so I might tack on a little time to my sermon, but I think it's a good video. So, here we go. It's brought to us by the Bible Project people, and they do a bang-up job of giving a big-picture overview of every book of the Bible. Okay?
Known as the wisdom literature. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job. And they're all asking the question, what does it mean to live well in this world?
So we've looked at Proverbs, who you could think of as a bright young teacher.
She's all about pursuing wisdom, an attribute of God that's woven into reality. And she's optimistic that if you use wisdom, you will build a successful life.
But then we come to Ecclesiastes, who's more like this sharp, middle-aged critic. And he says,
you think using wisdom will bring you success. You'd better think again, because life here under the sun is meaningless.
And that's a phrase he uses a lot in this book.
But to understand this book, we have to realize first that we're hearing two voices.
So first there's the teacher, and we've been calling him the critic. He's the main voice in the book.
But he is introduced to us by another figure, the author. And he's the one who's collected the critic's words, and then at the end of the book summarizes everything and gets the final word.
So why does the author want us to hear from the critic?
Well, he wants to turn your view of the world upside down, and he's going to let the critic explore three really disturbing things about the world.
And we should warn you, these are pretty intense.
Yeah. So the first is the march of time, or as the critic says,
generations come and generations go, but the earth, it's been here long before us and will be long after. No one remembers people from long ago, and all the people yet to come, they too will be forgotten by those who come after them.
So, on a cosmic scale, you and I, we are just a blip. Stars are born, and then they die and form planets which orbit new stars, and those planets, they change over time and eventually burn up.
And amidst this cosmic backdrop, my entire existence is like a blink in time.
Which leads to the critic's second disturbing observation, that we are all going to die.
Humans face the same fate as the animals, death. All people, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, those who offer sacrifices to God and those who do not, they all share the same destiny. All this activity and madness, then we all join the dead.
Man, this book is depressing.
And so is the final disturbing thing for the critic, and that is life's random nature.
So in Proverbs, life isn't random. There's a clear cause and effect relationship between doing the right thing and being rewarded.
But the fact is that life doesn't always work that way. The critic has observed a glitch in the system. He calls it chance, or in his words,
the race doesn't always go to the swift, or the battle to the strong. Nor does food always come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the educated. Time and chance happen to them all.
So his point is that you can't really control anything in life. It's just way too unpredictable.
So if I want to master life,
then you're setting yourself up for a fall. Now, throughout the book, the critic uses a metaphor to tie together all of these disturbing ideas. Nearly 40 times, he says that everything in life is hevel. It's a Hebrew word that means smoke or vapor. Like smoke, life is beautiful and mysterious.
It takes one shape, and before you know it, it takes a new shape.
And smoke looks solid, but try and grab it, it'll slip right through your fingers.
And when you're stuck in the thick of it, like fog, it's impossible to see clearly.
Now, our modern translations have lost the metaphor, and they usually translate hevel as meaningless. But if you read closely, the critic isn't saying that life has no meaning, but rather that its meaning is never clear. Like smoke, life is confusing, it's disorienting and uncontrollable.
So, what are we supposed to do with all of this?
Well, surprisingly, the critic first of all acknowledges the perspective of Proverbs. He says it's a really good idea to learn wisdom and to live in the fear of the Lord.
Really? I mean, he just said that doesn't guarantee success.
But he knows it's the right thing to do. But secondly, and more often, he says that since you can't control your life, you should stop trying. Learn to hold things with an open hand, because you really only have control over one thing, and that's your attitude towards the present moment. Stop worrying, he says, and choose to enjoy a good conversation with a friend, or the sun on your face, or a good meal with people that you care about.
The simple things in life.
Yes, and both the good things and the bad, because both are rich gifts from God. And that's the surprising wisdom of Ecclesiastes.
Listening to the critic is painful and can lead you into some dark places.
And that's why the author speaks up at the end of the book. He doesn't want you to lose hope. He wants to make you humble into someone who trusts that life has meaning even when you can't make sense of it, that one day God will clear the hevel and bring his justice on all that we've done. And so he tells us that the proper response to all of this is to fear the Lord and keep his commandments.
And that's the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, there's one more voice in the Bible's wisdom literature, and that's the book of Job.
And he will bring us the final. Okay.
All right, so that kind of gives you a big picture. Obviously, we're not going to tackle some of the things you talked about here this morning. But anyway, vanity, vanity, or meaningless, meaningless. I mean, why would anyone want to write such a meaningless book? Now, the question is, who is the author of this book? We're actually not told who the author is, only that he is, this is verse 1 in Ecclesiastes 1:1, that he is a teacher. He's the son of David, a king in Jerusalem. So this leads many people to think that he is King Solomon. And he may very well be the author of Ecclesiastes. After all, he is both the son of David. He is a king in Jerusalem, or he was a king in Jerusalem. He is an author. He's a person who's known to be very wise. But as others point out, the phrase, the son of David, or a king in Jerusalem, could actually refer to any king in Jerusalem. Solomon identifies himself as the author in Proverbs, but he doesn't do the same thing in Ecclesiastes. So to be consistent, you would think he would reveal himself in Ecclesiastes as he did in Proverbs. But I kind of lean toward King Solomon. My old professor said, Eugene Peterson, he observed, King Solomon began as the wisest king of Israel, but he actually ended up being, at the end of his career, the most foolish king in Israel. So if Solomon is the author, perhaps God has chosen Solomon to share from his vast experience, both from his wise times, but also from his foolishness. He's experienced both sides of the equation. Now, why was this book written? The people of Israel basically have taken their focus off of God onto other priorities. Israel used to be this small nation, a farming nation, depending on the Lord for their daily bread. Sometime during the reign of the kings, perhaps during the time of Solomon or afterwards, new opportunities came through international trade, such as trading with Egypt and other thriving nations. And a fortune could be made overnight. And so Israel was tempted to scramble and get rich overnight. The critic mentions several of these priorities, maybe what they chased after, many of the subjects tackled in this book: labor, wisdom and knowledge, pleasures and riches. We're all going to address some of these issues as the Sundays go by here, but mostly in Ecclesiastes chapter 1:1-11, it's kind of an introduction that we're going to look at. But one topic it does look at is the topic of labor or work. And it repeats itself, actually, later in the book. The teacher begins broadly by saying, look, life is meaningless. Everything is meaningless. But then he narrows things down to a few certain issues and topics. So let's let the cynic speak, and let's hear what he has to say. The first thing he says is basically this: there is no gain for man in his labor. This is verse 3. The critic cries out, meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. What can you gain from all your toil? You know, we are all children of the 21st century. You know, our labor can earn us basically a fairly good living, giving us access to a world of comforts and conveniences like the world has never known before. Did you know that? I mean, this is the wealthiest time in the universe of all time. Ecclesiastes contains, I think, one of the most relevant messages for us today. So the key verse is, of course, partly what you heard. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? You know, I think people might respond to such a phrase and say something like this. What are you talking about, teacher? I finally get a decent check. Because of my job and my successful career, I can buy a house I really wanted. I can fill it with nice furniture that I really want. And I can make life comfortable. Is there something wrong with this? You know, when someone drops a wet blanket on you and says something like this, we get a little defensive and maybe a little bit confused. I mean, after all, Proverbs teaches us that hard work and labor is a good thing. Talks about the ants who labor and work hard and says it's a good thing. What's wrong with labor? What's wrong with work? So what is the critic really saying? Is he really saying that our work and our labor is meaningless? No, I don't think the teacher is saying that work is meaningless. That's not what he's trying to say. After all, you know that God created ourselves to work. We could argue in the opposite direction about the importance of labor and work. I mean, without it, life would be very boring, right? And nothing would really happen. Life would not happen. But the video, I think, gives us a good clarification. The word meaningless may not be the best translation because the Hebrew root hevel actually is picture language. Hevel simply means breath or smoke or vapor. And like vapor, you can't reach out and grasp it and then try to control it in the way you want. It may look solid, then you go try to catch it, and then your hand goes right through it. You can't control it in the way you want. It's like trying to catch a fly with chopsticks. You try, but then it's impossible. So the critic is not saying your jobs, your career, or your desire to be this and that is a wrong thing. So the question is, what is he really trying to say here? If work itself is not meaningless, what is he saying? Well, he actually uses another word. He uses the word gain in that phrase. What does a man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? The word gain is, you know, a commercial word. It means to profit. It's not that your jobs or your careers are meaningless, but what we hope to gain from it is where we often go wrong. Because many people think that your careers and your jobs is what brings you ultimate meaning and purpose in life. And where we go so far is creating a whole identity out of it. I am a doctor, right? I am a carpenter. It becomes so much a part of us to the point where we think this is what brings us meaning in life. My career, my job. This is what brings us purpose in life. And so if we go on to that logical thinking, then we put all of our eggs in this one basket. Now again, Ecclesiastes, as you read on, he'll talk about the gift of work and the beauty of work. So he's not saying work itself is meaningless. It's a gift of God. But if we think that work, our labor, our hard work will bring you ultimate joy and meaning, then we have made too much of work, you see? We've made too much of work. And we are wrong to think that the resources that come from the ground, whether it's the trees, whether it's the oil, whatever natural products that we gain from it, if we think that is what brings us lasting, eternal satisfaction and meaning, then we're dead wrong. That's what's meaningless. It's like a vapor. You can't control it. Someone can earn a great wage and earn a whole pile of things and build many houses and do all kinds of investments, and suddenly, overnight, it could all change through an accident. Bang, changed. And then everything you put in that basket is simply gone. There has to be something else. Labor also brings misery. The word for labor or toil does mean physical work, but the word is often used to mean anguish. So this is where we have the word laborious or toilsome. We kind of attach something to it. And then we have this sense of anguish or misery in work. Well, this is really consistent with the consequences from Genesis chapter 3, as we know, the fall. When the fall came as a result of man's sin, God said to Adam, "Curses is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return." Romans also says in 8:20 that creation was subjected to futility. Now, that word futility means pointlessness or vanity. All the sweat and all the anguish we go through in work is rather pointless if we think that work itself can bring us ultimate meaning. And so when work becomes our master, we become miserable people and we fail to bring glory to God. So when we go overboard on the work side, we invite imbalance in our life. And sometimes our marriages get ignored. Sometimes our children get neglected. And we leave no spiritual breathing room for God to speak and work in your life because work has become dominant. Work is not a necessary evil. Work itself is not meaningless. But when we let it control us and thinking that this work can achieve for us what we want, then we actually cheapen the gift of work that God gives to us. If we think work and more work can bring us ultimate meaning and purpose, it is like vanity. like trying to catch a mosquito with chopsticks. It's impossible. We can never achieve the ultimate goal by work itself. In fact, it will make you miserable. Now, I probably mentioned this story before, but when I was in grade 10, my dad found a job for my twin brother and I at the local Sony electronics plant. And I'm a missionary kid, so I grew up in Japan, so there you go. Sony plant was in town. So for 2 months plus, maybe it was 3 months, I don't quite remember, my brother and I were put on an assembly line, dressed in all blue, doing exercises at regular moments. And we built what it's exactly called, but it was a 3-in-1 unit. It had a miniature television, a cassette player, and a radio, all bound for China. And this is 1980, and it was high-tech stuff, right? High-tech stuff. And so all I did all day long, 8 hours a day, was press in 3 little knobs, 1, 2, 3, horizontal, vertical, contrast, and put in a sticker between the two wheels of the cassette tape. Do you remember that, what I'm talking about? Okay. So 3 knobs, 1, 2, 3, sticker. Next, 3 knobs, sticker, 3 knobs, sticker, all day long, 8 hours a day, right? This is a 16-year-old boy we're talking here, okay? 16-year-old. I was grouchy in the evenings. I was grouchy in the morning. My dad had to get us out of bed, and we did not want to go to work at all. So it was the most miserable summer of my life, I would think. Not even payday made me happy, all right? It was crazy. So the teacher of Ecclesiastes is saying essentially, your life, your work life is like a miserable assembly line, right? Around and round life goes. No matter what you do to try to control it, you're never going to find meaning and true meaning out of that work, that assembly line. No matter how hard you work, no matter how you try to control it or fangle it, whatever. Hardworking men, they just work more. Maybe if I work a little more, make a little more money, then I'll feel better about myself, da, 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 da. And all that work and all that misery and all that assembly line stuff amounts to nothing. Now, why? Well, the author goes on. He talks about life under the sun. Under the sun, verse 3, is an expression found only in Ecclesiastes. And it's another predominant theme. It's actually found 29 times in Ecclesiastes. It refers to living on this earth, this side of the sun, in a sense, this side of heaven, without taking God into consideration. So you might see it as a horizontal, only horizontal perspective of life with no regard for the vertical. Right? The vertical is non-existent. All you see is the horizontal. You know, in Ecclesiastes 1:1-11, the name of God is never mentioned. And I think it's actually intentional. It's part of the author's technique, as if to say, look, if you try to live your life under the sun without acknowledging God, your life is just a bunch of hot air, vapor, a breath, smoke, a mirage. Ever try to chase a mirage down the highway? Looks like a pool of water. You drive a little more. What? Where did it go? Another mirage. Drive further. It's gone. So the author is saying, look, if you try to find your meaning, ultimate meaning, through your work or whatever else, and God is not part of your equation, it's just hot air. Your work, in fact, your job and your career will become less meaningful when God is eliminated. Your work will be devalued. Your life is devalued. Life itself is devalued when God is taken out of the equation. You know, we can launch a career, be very successful, make a boatload of money, get titles to your name, get honored, get certificates, make lots of friends. But from a strictly human point of view, without God at the center, all our successes on earth are just fleeting, just riding to the finish line on the wrong horse. No meaning at all. Well, let's quick look at nature here. I know time's getting away here. But nature says the same thing. There is no gain for creation in her toil. So basically, we're given three examples from Ecclesiastes in kind of a little poem here. Let me read it to you. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north, and round it goes. All the streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place where the streams come from, there they return again. So very quickly, the author is talking about the three cycles in nature that he finds. The repetition sun cycle, up, down, up, down, up, down. Okay, winds blowing around in a circuit. And of course, the cycle of nature, what you learned in, at least I learned it in biology 9 or something, grade 9, the hydrologic cycle. I'm not that smart, I had to look that up to remember. Okay. So there you go. Water comes down into the sea, goes up into the sky, comes down again, and round it goes. Now, why would the critic use nature to illustrate the meaningless of life? In Psalm 19, King David says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies above proclaim his handiwork." But you see, if mankind chooses to eliminate God from their lives, then all of creation no longer reflects the glory of God. It's just this mad cycle. It's just an assembly line. If your life is reduced to life simply under the sun, worshiping, in a sense, creation and not God, we can never bring glory to God, and meaning is sucked from our life, no matter how successful you are. And as the author will keep talking about, all this consumption, all this stuff, at the end of the day, is nothing. Because you die. And where does it go? So we're going to keep studying Ecclesiastes, and we're going to explore more themes and more themes. And this meaningless stuff, you're going to hear more meaningless sermons here, folks. Okay? But we'll touch on more themes, like pleasure, like riches, like wisdom. What's wrong with wisdom? Isn't wisdom good? And yet he even cast doubt on wisdom as well. But let me just show you a few things to reflect on here as we close. The goodness and sacredness of work is based on faith in Jesus Christ. Now, I haven't tied up all the loose ends here, okay? Ecclesiastes will end with the subject of fearing God and obeying his commandments at the very last chapter of Ecclesiastes. But of course, you know, the Old Testament is not a complete story. And so this is why we also need to talk about faith in Jesus Christ. Why? Because Jesus says, "I have come to bring you life so you may have it to the full." We sang about Jesus today, right? There's a good reason for it. Because without him, our life would have no meaning. He is the one who completes it. So, faith in Jesus Christ is what brings you meaning. Bring glory to God by working with integrity. We should know better, shouldn't we, as believers, that when we work with integrity. In our world, there's a temptation to cut corners and cheat. But that's not who we are. So true work glorifies God, brings true meaning to our work when we glorify God, and that means we do it with integrity. Be prayerfully dependent on God, not our self-sufficiency. You know, work has a way of producing pride in us. Look what I have accomplished. Look what I've invented. Look what I can do. But no, be prayerful, prayerfully dependent, which means humility before God and men, and not your self-sufficiency. And finally, be a witness for Jesus Christ as you work for him. That text speaks about letting the light shine, your light shine before men. May Jesus Christ flow from our life, our work life, because all of work is actually worship, right? All of work is meant to glorify God, and us as children are children of light, meant to glorify God so the world may know who we are and who God is. All right, well, let's close in prayer. Lord, thank you for this gift of Ecclesiastes. A little hard to get our minds around it sometimes, philosophical, a little deep in nature, but I pray that it will help us to be a good corrector, a good critic, to help us see the error of our ways and to get our minds back on Jesus Christ, because you have come to bring us life and to have it to the full. In Jesus' name, we